He also admitted to 11 murders.
This seems like an impossible task.
Minimize the amount of time that we have to put our divers into that environment.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me in the studio today is...
Hi, everybody. It's former state and federal prosecutor Francie Hakes. How are you, Jim?
I'm good. Thank you. And I'm really eager to finish this story with Bobby Jacone. How you doing, Bobby?
Good. Thanks for having me back and help me finish the story.
Great. Well, we talked a little bit about the fact that you were commuting home, and that commute, although it would have been 3 hours, turned out to be a much longer commute, didn't it?
Yeah, it turned out to be more three or four days. And, you know, it's one of those things you never know what's on the other end of that phone when it's ringing.
Yeah. Well, let's get back into the story when you got called to Anchorage, Alaska.
So, Bobby, they've identified who they think is the kidnapper, or at least they found Samantha's debit card on a man in Texas, which clearly leads us to believe that Israel Keyes is the man who took her. When did you all become involved from that point?
So I believe that he was arrested in Texas on a Wednesday or a Thursday. He was transported back up to Alaska on Friday, and I got the call Friday night.
So you said early on that the reason you all were called so urgently was because the suspect, now we know Keyes, was in custody and was talking. Is that right? He was talking to authorities, so he was making admissions, giving a confession?
Yes, that's correct. The investigators did a phenomenal job of getting him to talk right away. You'd have to talk to them on how they were so successful so quickly. But yeah, they found out right away that he was involved, and he actually gave them the location of Samantha's body.
Right. But in the meantime, he also admitted to 11 murders that he had committed over the course of a few years. And in the course of these debriefing interrogations, they would find out information that really stunned not only those agents, but the law enforcement community in general.
Well, I can't leave that laying there, Jim. What kind of information is that?
Well, Israel Keyes, it turns out, had decided to move to Alaska to become a serial killer because he figured that nobody would be looking for a serial killer in Alaska. So what he would do is he would go down, he would take a flight to the lower 48, and he would land in a city. He would rent a car, pay in cash. He would drive up to 1,000 miles, go to a Home Depot, buy what he would call a kill kit. He would have one of those bright orange buckets. He would have duct tape, plastic bags, sometimes acid, a gun, cash. He would do bank robberies and put cash in there. And then he'd casually walk away because he didn't have the cash on him, and he would be masked when he would do the bank robbery. So he would be funding this series of serial killings by doing bank robberies. As a result of this, he had done a number of trips across the country to many different locations, and he set up these kill kits, and he would memorize the GPS coordinates of each one of them.
Did he put them in a storage unit, or where did he put these kits?
No, he buried them in the ground. So then he would fly back to Alaska and live his life. And then when he wanted to kill somebody, he would fly to another city. He would drive to one of these kill kits up to 1,000 miles away, apparently. And then he would unearth them and then lay in wait. He basically set a trap, and whoever came into his trap, that's who he would kill.
Truly random.
Absolutely. And then he would typically get on a boat and go on a 2-week cruise and then get back to Alaska and continue to live his life. He actually was a contractor there. He was building and had a very successful career there. He also had a girlfriend and a 12-year-old stepdaughter, if I'm not mistaken. Right, Bobby?
Yes, he did.
One of the reasons why he didn't want to give up all of his kills was because he didn't want his stepdaughter to learn about his crimes. He was very reluctant about that. And after giving up 11 of these murders, he actually killed himself in prison, and we never discovered any more of his murders. However, I believe there are either 32 or 36 trips that he took that would have been these, quote, kill type trips. And so one of the benefits for him of living in Alaska is it's very sparsely populated. There's not a lot of law enforcement running around checking things every day. And so he basically avoided the major city law enforcement by doing that. But the other thing is that it's kind of a bottleneck. So Alaska, you have to fly in and out of there. You can't really walk. You can't really drive. You can't really take a boat right away. And most of the winter anyway, it's really harsh to do that. So flying is really the only way to do it. So there's only a certain number of airlines that go into there. So it's easy to track his movements. However, we couldn't find out where he drove because he would rent a car by paying cash. And then when he returned these cars, it'd be at least 2,000 miles on them.
Well, I'm struck by the difference in Bobby's case of Samantha Koenig and his other cases where he goes through this elaborate process to stay anonymous. And yet in his town where he lives, he has kidnapped a young woman on video.
Yeah, he made a series of mistakes, I think, in this case. And Jim might be able to provide more insight on that.
Yeah, so it appears that what had happened was he had just gotten away with, I believe, a double homicide, a very brutal homicide. He had staked out a motel, I believe. It was raining, and it was on the East Coast. And the person he decided he was going to kill, the next person who pulled into the parking lot, and a guy pulled in, and because it was raining, got out of the car and ran to his hotel room. Israel was not able to intercept him. He was very frustrated. And so what he did, apparently, was just walk through the woods next to this motel, and he emerged into a residential neighborhood. He walked up to a house. I believe he looked into the garage to make sure there were no children living in the house because, again, his 12-year-old stepdaughter. And he determined that was the case. He broke into the garage, then broke into the main house, held the couple hostage, took them to an abandoned building, raped the wife in front of the husband, and raped and killed the wife and the husband, and then I believe burned down the house. And the way this was covered was just that it was a fire in an abandoned house. Nobody discovered the bodies. And I think that what happened was he got such a high off of getting away. Nobody even knew that he was operating. He was a serial killer. He was operating throughout the United States. He lived in the safety of Alaska. And he kind of just started believing his own hype that he was invulnerable. And I think the high from this kill got him so excited that it overcame all of his intelligence and all of his planning. And he did the worst possible thing, which was a very bold and very open and notorious abduction right in his own hometown.
To highlight some of the mistakes he made, when he drove Samantha away from the Common Grounds coffee kiosk, he realized she had forgotten her cell phone. He actually went back to the kiosk by himself, kept her bound in the truck, and got her phone. And then as he was driving her back around town, back to his house and his shed where he was going to keep her, he told her that this was strictly a kidnap for ransom. And she said that, you know, her family didn't have much money, but that she shared an ATM bank account with her boyfriend. When he asked for the ATM card, she said, "I keep it in my truck that I share with my boyfriend." He then puts her in his shed, which he has pre-rigged to restrain people, and drives to her house that she shares with the boyfriend and goes into the truck that's in the driveway. The boyfriend then confronts him, not seeing who he is, but seeing a figure in the driveway. runs out there and basically chases him off, but he had already gotten the debit card out of the truck. And so there was actually a confrontation between the boyfriend and Keys in the driveway. It was dark and it was quick and he got away. But that's just another of these, you know, that first night of the mistakes that he was making that he hadn't made, you know, in his previous crimes.
Yeah, because he was very, very thoughtful and the planning and execution were perfect for all his other crimes. This was impulsivity to its max, very high risk behavior. And in the end, that very debit card was what is going to take him down.
Well, and what a horrible memory that the boyfriend has to live with, because presumably Samantha was still alive at that moment of that confrontation. And it must be very difficult for him to live with the knowledge of, if I had done something different, not that this is the case, but I'm sure he can't help thinking, if I had done something different, maybe she would have lived.
Yes. And in fact, that she still was still alive when that happened, because he stopped on the way back to test the code that she had given him for the ATM card, because he wanted to make sure that she gave him the right code, because if she hadn't, he probably would have gone back now with the ATM card and made sure she gave him the right code. Of course, when he went back to the shed, knowing now that the ATM card works, he then sexually assaulted her and strangled her.
And this is, of course, in his backyard with his girlfriend and his 12-year-old stepdaughter in the house just yards away.
Right. And then he packed up and went on a cruise with the daughter and with the girlfriend for 10 days to Mexico, I believe.
So, Bobby, he may have gone on a cruise, but he clearly did something with Samantha's body. What did you learn during the course of your involvement in this case happened to her either before or after this cruise?
Well, it was after the cruise, and this is through later interrogation by the agents and the detectives, but later he got back from the cruise and her body was frozen solid, obviously, after being in there for, you know, almost 2 weeks now in the cold Alaska spring. And then he used a tool to dismember her so that he could more easily dispose of her body. And to do that, he drove about 40 miles north of Anchorage to a large lake and walked out on the lake. And as is very common to do, and you'll see this in Anchorage or in Alaska in general, or places like that, the lake is covered with these small little portable huts that go up fairly quickly and easily. And it's for ice fishermen. And they drill a hole in the ice with an auger, and they sit inside these little tents that sometimes have a heater in them, and sometimes they have food in there. And they spend all day sitting over that hole fishing. And he had a kit like that, and he put everything on a sled, like they do, like fishermen do. He walked out to a part of that lake, set up his tent, you know, drilled a hole in the ice and sat in there and took her parts out and weighted them down and one by one dropped them in the water. He actually brought out one or two body parts at a time. There were five in total from his truck on his sled, which isn't uncommon for fishermen to go back and forth from the parking lot. He had her body parts wrapped and then he took them one or two at a time out to his tent, brought them into the tent, and then unwrapped them, weighted them down, and then put them in that hole.
Wow, this is grisly. But can you tell us then, Bobby, what you did when you got to that lake with your team?
Sure. When they heard this story on that Friday night, they dispatched a highway patrolman to go up to the lake. They actually went out on the lake, and you know, these lakes have now a series of frozen over holes from fishermen that had been there previously. He had said that he covered his hole with a small piece of plywood and set it on fire to basically promote the melting of the ice and then refreezing. Sure enough, when the highway patrolman went up there, they found a half-burnt piece of wood now basically covered over into the ice. So we felt confident that we had the right spot. So when we got up there, they led us up to the first we got to Anchorage. We saw his shed, by the way. The evidence response team had taken up his entire shed, much like they did in the Unabomber case. They took his entire shed, and it was sitting in the garage of the FBI office being processed for any kind of evidence that might be there. So we looked at his shed, and then we went up to the lake, and we looked at the burned piece. Now, the hole has now long since been frozen back over, but we were confident that we had the place that he was describing. And we felt confident that, you know, Samantha was below us at the bottom of that lake.
And so what is the diameter of the auger that you use?
The one that we used was about 10 to 12 inches in diameter. That was the round hole that we first used. and we drilled our first hole so that we could deploy a sonar that goes to the bottom, or actually sits about 3 feet up off the bottom of the lake, and does a scan for us. And it scans for any kind of image, any kind of object that might be down there. So we immediately sunk our sonar and we started doing 360-degree.
And how deep was this lake, Bobby?
At that point of the lake, it was only about 45 or 50 feet deep.
Yeah, but that's really deep. I don't really know how things work when everything gets frozen, but this seems like an impossible task to me to find pieces of this poor woman's body in a lake from one hole.
You know, the first couple of sonar images are really what's telling for us. We want to know that there's not a lot of down trees or debris on the bottom. If it was a mining operation before it was flooded, you know, you might have even outbuildings or vehicles down there. So the first couple of scans on the sonar really tell us what we're dealing with. And when we looked at the first couple of scans in the very first few minutes, we realized it's a very clean bottom, no trees, no obstructions, not even a very rocky bottom. It looked like a very smooth bottom. Very consistent bottom, and we immediately noticed five objects laying in that immediate area. That, you know, sonar doesn't give you photographs, it just gives you shadows and shapes, but we immediately saw five distinct images or five distinct objects in that immediate area.
But a 10-inch diameter hole is not something that a human being can fit through. How are you going to get down there?
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Right. The first step is the 10-inch hole for the sonar. The second one, now that we have five potential objects that we want to look at, we drill a bigger hole, and you simply do that by drilling two auger holes 10 inches around, and then you use your chainsaws to cut a bigger hole. That hole was about a foot and a half by 3 feet, and in that we put our small underwater robot. So we wanted to sail our robot down because all of this is in an effort to minimize the amount of time that we have to put our divers into that environment. So the more information we can get before we do that, the better. So now we fly our robot down to these five objects. The robot happens to have an arm, the manipulator arm that can move things, and it also has two cameras, front and back. One is a full high-def color camera, one is a low-light black and white camera. So we flew that, we kept the sonar in place, and we flew that robot right up to the first object that we saw. It was a long oblong shape object. And we put the robot on the bottom right next to that object, and we waited for the silt to settle because we know on a soft lake like that, there's going to be a lot of silt on the bottom. We waited a few minutes and then we turned on the camera. And the first thing we saw when we turned on the camera was a human foot.
Oh my God. So now you know, I mean, unless it's a massive and crazy sick coincidence, you think you have the spot where Samantha's remains rest.
Right. And, you know, I'm in a small pop-up shelter with the operators of these equipment, and the case agents are over my shoulder wanting to know when they can make the call back to Anchorage to confirm that we have her, because both the police chief and the head of the FBI office in Anchorage are about to make a statement to the press. And so they're really waiting. And when we first saw the five objects on the sonar, he wanted to make the call. I asked him not to. I said, this is just imagery. We don't have a photograph yet. Please wait. We can't confirm it's human remains until we see a photograph. Once I saw the human foot on our camera, I turned to him and I said, you can at least confirm to your boss that we have human remains on the bottom of the lake here. I can't say who it is, obviously, but I can tell you we have human remains, and I'm going to send my divers to go get it. And so we left the sonar in place. We now left the robot in place, and now we started to cut a much bigger hole that was going to accommodate my two divers that I was going to deploy down to recover these five pieces.
Oh, Bobby, I mean, we've talked before about the grim work that you and your team had to do in order to recover remains versus rescuing people. And so I can only imagine the mindset of the divers that had to go down. And for those of you waiting to see the remains come up, tell us what happened when your divers went down.
You know, my biggest source of pride was always the professionalism of my divers. And while we're doing this, we're completely focused on doing that job. We're not letting our emotions of the moment affect us. And so I took two of my best divers, I knew who can handle it, and realized that when two divers in the water, I have eight guys up top keeping them alive. So everybody's got a job to do. Even if those divers are in the water, there's guys tending their umbilicals, there's guys making sure that the air on the surface is getting pumped down to them, there's guys monitoring their life support equipment. So everybody is working, not just the divers in the water. The divers follow the umbilical of the robot. The robot works off an umbilical cord. So they follow that right down, and it puts them right smack down in front of the first object, which is what we saw on the foot. And the divers carry body bags. We have special underwater body bags that they carried with them. And they have video cameras on their helmets, and they're talking to us as they're going down, and they can see what they think we're looking for. And when they arrive at the first one, as we normally do, one diver on one side, one diver on the other, they unfurl the bag that is rolled up and attached to them, and they put the first piece into the bag. Our normal procedure would have been five bags for five pieces, but in this case, we were asked not to allow the detail that the body has been dismembered to get out to the press. So we wanted to make sure that if they saw us coming, because now the press is all around the perimeter of the lake with high-powered lenses filming us. And by this time, word has gotten out. And so that was a demand made by Keyes himself. He did not want his 12-year-old daughter or 11-year-old daughter or whatever to read in the papers that he had dismembered the victim.
Bobby, I find that really interesting. I expected you to say that the reason you were putting it in one bag had something to do with a request from the family, because at that point, Keyes is in custody. He has confessed. My question was going to be, why on earth are you concerned about what Keyes wants?
Well, that's more of a Jim question, because, you know, the interrogators are playing this cat and mouse game with him, and he was withholding certain information on other murders. He was playing this game with the interrogators. For example, I believe he made the demand that he wanted to only speak to female interrogators because he wanted to tell a woman what he had done sexually to his other woman victims. So there was this high-level psychological game going on between him and his interrogators about what information he would give and share. So he, in some small way, he had some leverage in this process. And one of the things he said was, I'll completely clam up if you let it out that she's been dismembered. I won't talk to you anymore and you won't know anything about my other murders. So we acceded to at least that demand temporarily. Her family didn't know we were up there looking for her yet, and it had nothing to do with her family, although we would always try to protect them from the horror of that. But normally, for forensic value, we would bag each one separately, but in this case, we didn't. And mainly because when we take the bag out of the water, the press can see it. We ultimately moved the shelter over the hole so that we could protect it as much as we could from the prying eyes of the media. But when we brought her up, it was one dive. They went down. They got all five pieces. They were all within, I would say, a 15-foot diameter from each other, and all five pieces in one bag, and the divers came back up. The entire dive took about 45 minutes, start to finish, and the divers out of the water, and we had Samantha back.
Oh, Bobby, I just, this is so gruesome. And, you know, you see things like this on Jim's show, Criminal Minds, this kind of gruesome dismemberment and disposal of remains, but it's still, I just can't imagine how difficult it must have been for the team to pull up 5 pieces of a young woman's body and deal with that horror. I mean, as a prosecutor, I've certainly seen crime scene photos of victims who were dumped in the water. And it is a horrifying, horrifying effect water is on human remains. And I feel like it's nightmare inducing.
Well, yeah, in this case, there wasn't as much decomposition to the body as normal because it was very cold water and it was fresh water. Warm and salt water are really devastating to a body. But in this case, even though Samantha was probably in the water 4 weeks, the body was in relatively good condition. It was a little saturated, but when I opened the bag initially on the surface, I looked directly in her eyes and I could see that the eyes were in fact sewn open. But the body was in very good condition relative to other bodies that we've recovered. And that's mainly due to how cold the water was and how clean it was. There was, you know, at that temperature, even any fish life that might be present in that water is more dormant until the water warms up. So the body itself was not in that bad a condition, although whenever you're dealing with, you know, a dismembered body parts, particularly when you can see into the person's eyes, it's not, you know, it's not pleasant.
So Bobby, we can tell that this interrupted commute must have affected you tremendously. And obviously, because of your work, you were able to at least bring Samantha to a place where she could be put to rest in a decent and respectful way. And even though her family might have been pretty messed up, it's certainly good that you were able to provide them with some closure to this horrible incident. And as we all know, Israel Keyes took his own life, and therefore we don't know how many families out there will never get closure because their loved ones or spouses or siblings or friends will just never come home.
That's right. I mean, and then, you know, our guys late that night when we were all done and we hadn't eaten for the majority of the day and we were looking for dinner, it was 10 o'clock at night. One of the detectives called the only place that was still open, a small bar that served food, and they asked them to stay open for us. And the 10 or 12 of us went, and we went in there. And as we walked into this small local establishment, the few patrons that were left looked over, saw us all dressed in similar garb. The news was on the TV already talking about it, wall-to-wall coverage, of course, in Anchorage. And they all kind of didn't say anything, but all knew who we were. We sat down and we tried to have dinner. And there's a kind of a knowing silence that overtakes the team in situations like that. No one's really saying anything other than small talk, but there's a level of satisfaction that we did our job that we train all the time to do. And it's kind of a satisfying thing, but horrifying at the same time. It's just why the mantra that I used to tell my guys is when we have a good day, someone else is going to have a really bad day. And that's part and parcel of just what we were called to do. That was our role in the entire process. We never were called upon to save anybody. We weren't a fire department. We didn't rescue somebody that fell through the ice. We never saved anybody, but we brought them back and we hopefully helped that community heal. Because when we arrived in town, there were billboards, and I remember one in particular right in front of the gym that's right next to the coffee kiosk, and it said, "Samantha, we're waiting for you," or, you know, it was a sign of hope, in effect. And then as we were pulling out of town, heading back to the airport that night or that next morning, that sign had already been changed to read, "Samantha, rest in peace." And that change is what we affect. And I told our team, that's what we come into town to do, is to, in a way, snuff up that last bit of hope and get the community and the family back on the road to healing and to closure, because we know what's happened. And the quicker we can bring that into the consciousness of the people involved, the quicker they can get on, you know, with their life.
That's profound. Well, we really appreciate you coming on and giving our listeners an insight into a case that I believe they will be hearing about for decades to come, because I think cases will eventually crop up where bodies will be located, evidence will be uncovered, people will talk when they aren't talking now, and we'll find out more of the damage that Israel Keyes caused across this country.
I know there's a book being written about him by a New York Post reporter, and your listeners can actually go on YouTube, and there the interrogation tapes The FBI made them public after he killed himself because there's no right to privacy, obviously, anymore, and there's no legal process. So I think if you go onto YouTube, at least last time I checked, you can still see some of his interrogation tapes and the coldness and the calculatedness of this American serial killer.
So, Bobby, do you count this among your best cases or worst cases, and why?
You know, I keep going back to this when I'm on with you guys. I mean, it's both. It's somewhat of both. All of our cases where we bring the victim back is the best case for us. We're asked to go. We're asked to find this person. We're asked to bring them back. So for us, this is the best case. But I almost never want to say that without qualifying it, without conditioning it in that it's also a worst case because of the situation surrounding what happened or why we're called to it. I never want to say that the sexual assault, murder, and dismemberment of a 19-year-old girl is the best case, but that's the role me and my team played. And for us, this was the best case because we were able to bring Samantha home.
Got it. Well, thank you, Bobby. I'm sure that these cases, whether best or worst, continue to live with you. And I want to thank you for and your teammates for doing the work they did, because not only is it difficult and life-threatening, it is very, very, very heroic. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
So for now, signing off on Best Case, Worst Case.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Stories about child sexual abuse can make us feel powerless, but the good news is that there are organizations working to prevent abuse and keep kids safe. Darkness to Light and their Stewards of Children prevention training has trained more than 1.4 million adults to protect, recognize, and react responsibly to child sexual abuse.
But there's more work to do, and with their 4 million by 2020 goal, Darkness to Light is setting their sights on training 4 million adults around the country to keep kids safe. By donating to Darkness to Light, you can help reach this goal that will make communities across the country safer places for kids.
It starts with you. Visit www.d2l.org today to give. That's www.d2l.org.